You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week, this show will address many ways of creating greater health, joy, and love for you and those you care about. And we will introduce you to top professionals and talented authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a huge favor. Please forward at least one of your shows or one of these shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from today's subject. And I want everybody to know that this subject affects all of us, so everybody knows somebody who will be able to benefit from this, because this is just one powerful way that we can make a positive difference together. Now, I want you all to know that I am very grateful to all of you that take your time to watch or listen to this show, and especially those that are sending in questions, comments, reviews, and suggestions, because please remember, this show exists for you. Now, if you haven't gotten your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal yet, please go to our website at answers.network and download a copy. Give it 21 days and comment on whatever platform you listen to us on, what focusing on gratitude has meant for you and your loved ones. And if you would like to also send them to us via our website, we'll read some of them on the air. Now, our guest today, I believe, may also just have something to say about gratitude and how it applies to our earth. So a little bit of information. Our planet is showing us that we are consuming too much. And I don't think there's much argument about that. Because in America, we burn the earth's resources at a rate 5 times faster than it can regenerate. And despite efforts to green our consumption by recycling, increasing energy efficiency, or using solar power, and with the exception of serious global disasters, we have yet to see a decline in global carbon emissions. Our guest, J.B. McKenna, is the author or co-author of 5 books of nonfiction. As an award-winning journalist, his work has appeared in such publications as The New Yorker, National Geographic, and The Atlantic, as well as The Best American Science and Nature Writing anthologies. He is an adjunct professor of journalism at the University of British Columbia, where he teaches feature writing. JB's latest book is The Day the World Stopped Shopping, a thought experiment that imagines what would happen if we committed to consuming far fewer of the Earth's resources. Now, some of his previous works are The Once in Future World, a bestseller about rewilding the natural world, and The 100-Mile Diet, which he wrote with Alyssa Smith, widely recognized as a catalyst of the local food movement. JB also works in documentaries, most notably as a writer for Bear 71, an internationally acclaimed digital interactive that explores the interaction and the intersection of the wired and the wild worlds through the true story of a mother grizzly bear. That's got to be interesting. JB, welcome to Answers Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I got to tell you that I try to take the week before to research not only my guest, but their book and the subject matter. And it motivated me to watch some documentaries that I had seen in my past and wanted to see them again to sort of get refreshed on the subject. And it started to get me depressed. I mean, it really did. So I don't know if that's the reason, but why did you decide to write this book? Because on the one hand, I feel like it's something that we really need everybody to know about, but that might have also taken you down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, I've been an environmental journalist and writing on environmental topics for quite a long time. And I mean, I think in general, they are depressing subjects a lot of the time, unfortunately, these days. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I recognized about all of that writing was that it didn't really seem to matter what the particular environmental problem was, whether it was deforestation or overfishing or habitat loss or climate change. The list goes on. It didn't really seem to matter which of those I was focusing on. If I looked at what the root driver of that problem was, it was consumption. It was the global consumerism and our appetite for consuming the Earth's resources. And I wanted to take a look at that and address that directly. I think we often talk around consumption as the driver of these problems. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, I recognized that whenever we have seen consumption slow down, it really does have serious consequences in the economy and for people's livelihoods. I wanted to see if there was a way that we can get past that. You know, was there some way that we could get past this dilemma where the planet seems to need us to stop consuming so much, and yet the economy seems to need us to consume more and more?
Well, even though you had been writing on the subject for quite some time, what surprised you the most when you did the deep dive to write this book?
I think one of the things that really surprised me was the fact that of the two big drivers of environmental problems, population and overconsumption, overconsumption is now the greatest driver of our environmental problems. So I think a lot of us, and myself included at the outset of this project, would have thought that just the sheer scale of the human population and its constant growth was still the biggest problem, and consumption was secondary to that. But the UN, a UN panel that studies global resources, took a look at this, and by their measures, around the year 2000, they switched. Population and consumption switched. So consumption is now how much each one of us consumes now matters more than how many of us there are. And that was surprising to me. This is our biggest problem, and we don't really talk about it very often.
Well, it's surprising to me as well. But on the other hand, I would imagine that they go hand in hand.
They do. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not as though population disappears as a problem because consumption becomes the greatest one. But the way, you know, a way to picture it is that, as this panel pointed out, the average person in a rich country is now consuming 13 times as much as the average person in a poorer country. So that means, you know, if you're a North American family of four, if you have a couple of kids, then it's as though you had 26 kids in a poor country. Wow. So in a sense, consumption is a population problem. You know, we consume as much in the richer countries of the world as large groups of people in the poorer world do.
Wow. Now, I realized that you were writing this book before we got into this pandemic. How did that change what it is that you were writing? Because all of a sudden, you know, we weren't consuming as much and we were looking at things considerably differently. How did that change?
The pandemic was really interesting for me. It also created a lot of problems for me in a practical sense, but I had nearly finished this book as a thought experiment. I had decided that I would play out on the written page what might happen if the world suddenly and drastically reduced its consumer spending. How would that play out in the economy? How would we start to transform society to adapt to that? How would our products change? How would we as humans change? And then it happened. It happened in early 2020. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 2020 working really hard to keep up with the pandemic and everything that it was teaching us about this thought experiment that I had been playing out. And that was a lot of things. And so a lot of the things that I had been able really only to predict in my thought experiment began to come true in reality in the pandemic. So one very clear example of that is that we saw the sharpest drop in carbon emissions ever recorded. So when the world went into lockdown and we were closed off away from consumer culture, the result in terms of the emissions that drive climate change was really dramatic. And that was something that I had predicted, but there were many other examples.
Now, what would be some of the things that, that we can learn from this and where we can find a happy medium? Because obviously nobody wants to stay in a lockdown situation, but what are the things that, that we can do as citizens to get a little closer to a level that is workable to the planet as well as our lifestyles?
Well, one of the things that I learned through writing this is that while there's something very obvious that individuals can do, and that's reduce their consumption. That can be satisfying, and it can be deeply satisfying in a whole bunch of different ways, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. It can reduce our debt loads. It can give us a greater sense of control over our lives. It can give us more free time to use in other ways. I mean, I would never suggest to people that they not consider reducing their consumption as individuals. It's a great way. It's the most effective thing you can do in terms of reducing your environmental impact. That said, I think that what we really need to look at is making changes in the systems that we live within that make it easier for all of us to consume less. So one example of that would be, well, how do we stop this trend towards more and more disposable goods and move back towards durable goods, which many of us remember from the not too distant past? There are concrete things that we can do in that regard. We can require lifespan labeling for products. We can mandate that products be made repairable. We can reduce taxes and fees on repair and maintenance of products and increase them on newly made products. We can make products tell the ecological truth about the impacts. So we can build the costs, for example, of toxic pollution or climate emissions into the cost of products. That again would encourage us it would make it much more competitive to buy a long-lasting product than, say, to buy a it would make it more competitive, for example, to buy a sweater that's going to last us 30 years than to buy 12 sweaters across 30 years and be paying a higher cost for each of those 12 sweaters. So there's these concrete things we can do at every level of society that will help us make a world that consumes less rather than following the path that we have so far, which is mostly just asking people to consume less, making people feel guilty if they're consuming too much. It doesn't really make sense because we've built a consumer society, a consumer economy that runs on consumerism, and then we're supposed to feel bad about being consumers.
No, and I love the fact that you're approaching it this way, because I know that I've had banter with my kids that are in their 20s, for quite some time, to where, they'll look at me and go, "Dad, just throw it away and get another," and that's sort of a mindset that we've gotten into. And I'm still of that generation that would be, well, let's figure out how to fix it, and so because I think a lot of people think that, oh, okay, well, I guess if I go get a, an energy efficient car, if I go get an electric car, then I've done my part. But I like the fact that it involves everything that we're doing and how we're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I just talked a little bit about how we might reverse that trend from disposability towards durability. But there are many other things we could do. If we want to look at this at a really big picture level, for example, inequality is something that drives consumption and consumerism. And it does it in two key ways. One is that it makes us feel, if we see a lot of people, with a lot more things than us, then we are prone to try to keep up with the Joneses, right? If the Joneses are way out ahead of us, we're still going to try to keep up in various ways. And we're not doing that because we're greedy and covetous. We're doing it mainly because it's really important to people to feel like they have a dignified place in society. And if everyone's means and wealth permits them to have much more to show for their lives than you might have, it's very hard for us to feel like we have not kind of lost a position of status in society. Another thing that inequality does is just plain make us feel anxious about our material security. So if we feel like we're poorer or not as successful as most of the people around us, then we actually can feel, you know, just plain anxious that we don't have enough to be secure in that society. So addressing inequality can, you know, make a difference in nations like the United States or where I live in Canada. And people do feel less pressure to consume in those places. So these are the kinds of changes we can make, and some of them are big changes, but they point towards a very different kind of society. But it does allow us to say we can do it. You know, if we do want to create a lower consuming society, it's possible.
So you bring up a good point in regards to the inequality, but it also leads me to think about the level of advertising, the things that we are bombarded with now, and especially children are bombarded with the advertising of, if you don't have this, if you don't have the latest phone, or if you don't have the latest whatever, you're nobody, you know. And are there any things that are being done different? And you mentioned the Nordic countries. Is there anything that's done different that makes the advertisers not approach it the same way? And is it because they have greater equality so that there isn't as much of a desire? Or how is that working up there?
Yeah, there are countries that are taking a different approach to advertising than the United States. One thing that's increasingly common is limits on what can be advertised to children and mm-hmm. what kinds of messaging those advertisements can contain, how much advertisement can be directed at children. There are taxes that can be placed on ads so that it's more costly to produce advertising and get it out there in the world. Mm-hmm. There's just straight up regulation that can be applied to limit how much exposure we have to ads. I mean, certainly we will all have noticed how predatory advertising can be online, and the way that you can even, you just mention something, look up something once on Google out of curiosity, and then be bombarded with ads about that specific thing for the next 2 weeks. It's, we haven't even really begun to approach how we might limit that kind of activity by the big tech companies, but certainly we're at the point where a lot of people are uncomfortable with it. The point I guess I keep coming back to is that in each case, there are specific things we can do to reduce these pressures and limit these powers that drive us towards consumption and make it easier for us to live our lives according to a different set of values.
Well, with everything else that's going on right now, and, you know, it seems like the last year and a half has been like a trip to crazy town. Tell us why this story is actually the story of the moment, that this should be the focus of all of us.
Well, I think the main reason is that reducing consumption is critically important to addressing climate change and environmental problems. Those are the central existential questions of our time, and reducing consumption, moving towards a lower consuming society, is the most effective thing we can do. The reason that this moment is so important, though, is that, you know, as you said earlier, we've just been through this pandemic where, particularly early in the pandemic, a lot of us had an opportunity to reflect on our priorities and values. Mm-hmm. And get a little glimpse through the window of towards what a less consumeristic society might look like. And I think that this, to me, as we see people returning to full force consumerism, the type that we had prior to the pandemic, I see a lot of people moving back to that with mixed feelings. I mean, I think most of us are feeling some gratitude that we're able to be social again. We're able to live in our communities again. But I think a lot of us are also feeling anxiety and distress as we return to feeling these pressures to look certain ways and at certain times, to buy things, to compete with one another in a material sense, to spend all of those hours on the job to make the money that we need to make to spend and pay for all of those things and services and experiences. Certainly I am. And I think a lot of the people I've spoken to have said the same, that we're feeling ambivalent about consumption in a way that we haven't in a very long time.
And I don't think that that the pandemic's the only reason, but I, you know, what I see is a lot of people moving to more rural areas. I see a lot of people disconnecting their network television and or anything that is promoting this kind of divisive negativity. And some of them that I talk to are not going back to it. And I've done some of those things also. I was speaking to a friend that moved out of Los Angeles and moved into a much more rural area. And he said, you know, please come visit my little slice of heaven. So yes, I would agree that I think that there's a lot of people reevaluating what's important to them and staying in a highly stressful, where you're constantly bombarded with negativity and fear is no longer acceptable.
Yeah, and I think you see this. What I think is really interesting is that you see this at all kinds of levels of income and wealth. So among people who aren't as high of earners, you're seeing this really interesting reluctance of people to return to to frankly the terrible jobs, terrible, poor paying, low benefits jobs that so many people had. And so people, you were seeing that in Canada. I've read that's pretty widespread in the United States as well. And the last time we saw this was in the 1990s with this movement called downshifting, where kind of in reaction to the greed is good mentality of the 1980s and a recession in the early 90s that was already pushing people out of the workplace, you saw a lot of people actually making the choice to live a simpler life, earn a lower income, and enjoy the freedoms that come with that. And I think that's a lot of those people. I mean, people often look back at that downshifting era and picture it as one of kind of yuppies who dropped out and tried to live a little more simply. But in fact, a lot of those people weren't high income earners to begin with. They just didn't think they were getting a good deal out of the workplace and decided to try to live a different way. I think that's the same kind of feeling that we're witnessing right now.
Yeah, and I'm seeing it also because I do a lot of work with families, and especially if they're dealing with at-risk youth, where they're saying that we're going to spend more time with our children. We are not going to continue with this job that is taking away 16 hours a day of our time. And I see that as a huge positive, to get more families together, to get more families to where they are valuing that time together so much greater than making that extra buck so that they can have that one more new phone or TV or whatever it is that we're working so hard to get.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you had asked me about things that surprised me as I worked on this book. Another thing that surprised me was talking to psychologists who study materialism and having them tell me that, the reason that we're not pursuing these values around, strong relationships with family and friends and other people that are important to us, and our health, and even relationships to nature, giving back to our communities, things like that. The reason that we're not pursuing those values is not, again, because we're greedy or turning into, you know, awful, more covetous people in some way. It's because we don't have the time. Most of us feel totally swamped in our workload, our commutes, and then in the, you know, spending the money that we earn, finding goods, buying things, using services, traveling so that we feel like we're as well traveled and worldly as the people around us. Mm-hmm. Those things are eating up the time that we could put to these more inherently satisfying priorities. And that was surprising to me to learn that it really came down mainly, not to some grand cultural change or change in attitudes in our minds, but a simple question of time and how consumption and consumerism has eaten up so much of it at this point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, you've mentioned in the past or in your book that we've been thinking too simply about simpler living. And so when we come back, I'd like you to address that a little bit. So for everybody out there, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back, and we are talking about climate change. We are talking about consumerism, and we are talking about J.B. McKinnon. And when we left, my question was, you've been quoted as saying that we're thinking too simply about simpler living. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that we've spent too much time trying to pressure people into consuming less, scaring them into consuming less, guilting them into consuming less, and not enough time thinking about these systemic type changes that we can make that will make it easier for all of us to consume less and to express a less materialistic set of values. And I think when I talk to people who are longtime practitioners of simpler living, people who've been at it for decades, mm-hmm. and research into those people says this same thing. They report that, you know, certainly they don't seem any less satisfied with their lives than we do, and in many cases seem more satisfied with their lives. They don't feel like they're losing or sacrificing a lot in their lives. What they do feel is that they are outcasts. They feel like they live so differently that they're out of step with the people around them, and that's uncomfortable. I spoke to one woman who said that she had spent years feeling ashamed of her clothes because they were mostly secondhand clothes. She has been cautious through her life about who she invited to her home because her home was smaller and decorated with secondhand furniture. And some people she felt would interpret her as just unsuccessful in society because she's living by and expressing a different value set. So that suggests to me that it's, and research bears this out, it's difficult for us as individuals to make a change, you know, to decide to live simply, live, you know, march to the beat of a different drummer. Not very many of us end up being able to sustain big changes over a long period of time in the face of having to feel like they are outsiders in society. So again, it's, you know, we need to be trying to look at, well, how do we build whole communities that consume less, whole nations that consume less?
How much of that is advertising? Because I don't think of anyone, I don't look at them and think, you know, oh, well, you know, you're an outcast or anything. And I know that my kids don't. But on the other hand, it just seems like, you know, that this bombardment of things to where we're planting these seeds. And so it would seem to me that if we focused more on self-esteem, if we focused more on things to allow us, almost like we would have to build a shield for all of this bombardment, or as you said, regulate it to the point to where they can't bombard you quite so much. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think advertising is something that we really need to look at critically. I mean, my book is not a, you know, it's a story. It explores imaginatively the kinds of things that might happen, the kinds of changes we might make if we were to slow our consumption. It's not ultimately a policy manual. So I'm not here to say, I think there are these five specific things that we should do to reduce advertising, but we know that there are things we can do. And, right. You know, I think that we should be having a serious conversation about the power of advertising and what aspects of our life we allow it into and which ones we shut it out from. Because as you said earlier, I mean, in terms of where are we getting this messaging that we should feel inadequate, insecure, insufficient at all times? I mean, it's coming from a $600 billion advertising industry first and foremost. And we need to push back against that, I think.
Yeah. And as you said, you're an author, you're not the policymaker, but we need to get this information to the policymakers. And we have a question that's come in. And again, I thank those that take the time to send in the questions. This one, I think, ties right into what we're talking about. It says, at the beginning of various seasons, most notably summer and winter, there is traditionally this frenzy to get the latest styles, be it clothing, equipment, accessories, whatever. Now that they've had the lockdowns with this last summer, you know, a lot of friends and family are buying much more than in previous years that I call stress buying, with the triggers still coming in waves. I don't see this ending in the foreseeable future. So how and what do you think can help us slow us down and become more thoughtful, less obsessive consumers? And that's from Joanna in Minnesota.
Well, none of this really surprises me, right? This stress buying, it's been called revenge consumption, this kind of hyper response to the, you know, almost consumer withdrawal that we've experienced is exactly what would be predicted by history. We've seen it after recessions, we've seen it after wars. It might, in fact, have been effectively inevitable, given where we're coming from as a society. There are these kinds of, you know, solutions that we've been talking about, but I think one of them that I just really want to emphasize is that we need to be having a lot more public conversation about consumption. Yeah. We need to, I mean, we talk a lot about how we're going to convert the automotive industry to electrics. We talk a lot about efficiency, green technologies, these sorts of solutions. We very rarely talk in modern society about, could we just reduce our consumption? Are there levels of consumption that are simply socially inappropriate? And we saw glimpses of this again in the pandemic. I remember One, I think it was a film executive who was quarantining on his yacht in the Caribbean or something like that. And he was shouted off of Instagram by people saying, you know, that's a disgusting show of wealth at a time when a lot of people are suffering. What was interesting about that is that, you know, just a few weeks earlier, when the pandemic hadn't been announced, mm-hmm. that was the very bread and butter of Instagram, right? Was people showing off their wealth. So we can, you know, through, if we talk about this more, if we engage with it more, then we can start to change our value sets around it so that it's not as normal. It's not as acceptable to binge shop every summer and fall. And more importantly, it's not as acceptable for the fashion industry to push us to do that. It's not as acceptable for lifestyle media to issue another, you know, top 10 things you need to buy for this autumn. Messaging, you know, push, barrage, I think was the word you used earlier. And I think that's right. I mean, we're seeing this barrage from advertising and lifestyle media that's pushing us to get back to those malls. So we can, you know, if we can even just change the tone of that conversation, then I think we're making big strides.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. We have another question comment that has come in, and this one says, I really like the title of your book. My question is, small businesses were devastated by the pandemic because people were pushed to online buying for the majority of things that other than groceries or pharmacy related. And actually, I think people did that as well. Do you think that our valuable local small businesses can survive and rebound if we stop buying everything online? I personally go out of my way and will spend more than I should just to support my local community. What is your solution on this to restore our economy and our local businesses? And this is from Jordan in Nevada.
Well, certainly right now, my personal suggestion and my personal approach is we should be if we are buying things, we should be buying them from local businesses and supporting those local businesses. Absolutely. I mean, that's, it's preferable in a bunch of ways. Having to go out and actually physically acquire things makes us more mindful in our decisions about what we purchase. We keep the money in our communities where it does the most work for the people we care about. That's really valuable and important. The bigger question of, you know, how do businesses fare over the long run is if we reduce consumption, that's a bigger question and a more complicated one. But if we look at, for example, one idea that a lot of people talk about is that we move towards an economy of fewer, better things. And you can apply that to goods, services, and experiences. Mm-hmm. So we don't buy as many pairs of jeans, but we buy good quality jeans that are going to last longer. We invest in services that are really important to us rather than just spending willy-nilly on services. We travel less but more meaningfully rather than taking 5 international trips a year and not being able to remember which countries we visited, 6 months ago. So if we move towards that kind of a model, it producing higher quality things requires more labor. So we keep some of the jobs through that. It costs more money to buy, to buy better things and better experiences and so on. That supports the economy as well. You get whole new sectors that can open up, like repair and maintenance, sharing of products can be a valuable sector in a lower consuming society. You start to see that you can have a society with a functioning economy, one that can be, you know, as exciting and interesting as this economy, but very different. And that's a transition I think we make gradually in order to, you know, try to protect the people that are most vulnerable in these kinds of changes.
So what do we have to do to get copies of your books sent to every policymaker, legislator, and political head, or and even some of the pundits that are just talking heads, to get people focusing on some of these things? And I love the fact that it's there for everybody. And I agree with you that there's things that we can all do, but it seems like we could make so much greater headway if we can get it to some of the policymakers that can be of great assistance in getting this done.
I mean, that's a great idea. And I guess it's not a question I've been asked before. I mean, I suppose what I hope is that people are going to pick up this book and read it and enjoy it and spread it through their networks. And of course, you know, once things are spreading through people's networks, they reach far and wide. And hopefully there is somebody at somewhere in the network at some point that is pressing it into the hands of their local politician and saying, you know, read this book. It might change the way you look at, you know, what the real solutions to things like climate change might be.
Well, so there's your marching orders, everybody. So either buy two copies so that you can send it to one of your politicians, or wait till you finish reading the copy that you have and send it to them and let them know that these are things that are important to you, and it's going to be important in the next election cycle, and see if that makes a difference, because we know that that's one of the more important things to them.
Yeah, it's I can't emphasize enough that it's I think the biggest thing we can do around this subject right now is talk about it again. It's been 30 years since there was the last cultural wave where, you know, millions of Americans were actually talking about the subject of overconsumption and its effects on the world and on ourselves. If we can just get this conversation going again, then, you know, who knows where it will lead.
Yeah. And we have another comment that's coming in, and this one is sort of going towards, I think, on a very, very local level. It's more solution minded, but it said that a group of us were discussing how consignment and thrift stores seem to be popping up everywhere and appear to be great assets to our communities for those on tight budgets. It says, I bought a copy of your book and look forward to reading and recommending it to my friends and family, as I so agree that it is time to stop buying. And if we need to buy, to look at the used seller first option, it perhaps would help us more. And this is from Brendel in California.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate, I appreciate the fact that you're prepared to read my book and that you have the same sort of observation that you've made about the world around us. But something that's very positive on this front is that you are now starting to see companies, significant companies, moving towards a business model of not only producing new things and selling them to us, but also reselling their products when we're done with them. So Patagonia, of course, has been moving in this direction for some time, and a number of other smaller brands. But earlier this year, Levi's announced that it's moving in that direction. So, I mean, that's a large, globally recognizable brand that has a powerful voice among young consumers. And they, in April, outright acknowledged, and this is extremely rare among corporations, they outright acknowledged that overconsumption drives their industry, and that they, you know, want to start shifting towards models like, you know, making more of their company profit through things like repair and resale of their products secondhand, and less dependence on just cranking out new things. That's a big important change. I mean, Levi's isn't a perfect company, but that's a really important symbolic shift.
And, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense, because we are in a time in which these things can happen, you know, because if you look back 30 years ago, we probably couldn't have done this, because people, you know, just the idea of trying to ship something back, you know, was much more difficult. And now, you know, and I know that, I mean, you know, and not doing a commercial for Amazon, but I mean, it's set up in such a way that it's so simple to be able to ship things, you know, the way that they do it, to where you can walk into your UPS store or whatever and ship things anywhere in the world relatively inexpensively, which includes back to the manufacturer. I think you're right. This is the time, which I think goes to one of your points that you said is that this is the moment. This is the moment that we can do it. And maybe the things have aligned in such a way that it can happen and can happen on a big, big way.
Yeah, I mean, we're harnessing these new possibilities of the digital economy in, you know, in the worst possible ways, in some ways. We've figured out how to do instant delivery and sort of the frictionless shipping of products from place to place. But we're doing that at the same time as we've made, that we've made shopping as simple as feeling the impulse to buy and hit a button. And then, but we can use it to circulate goods, share goods, return goods for resale, you know, those sorts of things would actually help us reduce the number of new products that need to be manufactured. And the ecological consequences of that more circulatory type of economy are much, much lower. It's not as though it has no impact, but it's a dramatically lower impact than making things from scratch, selling them to us and having them disappear into the waste stream, you know, within a year.
All right. Well, we've just got a couple of minutes. So I'm going to hand you the magic wand. And so with that magic wand, what is the thing that you would do to make the greatest impact right now? You've been given the power. You're now the world leader.
I would do two things. I'll get through them really quickly. Okay. One of them is I would make products tell the truth about the consequences of how they're made. So I would build the ecological costs of products into their prices. That's the first, you know, magic wand thing I do. The second one, a lot more achievable for each of us, is I would ask, you know, I would hope that people would turn, would start to think about reducing consumption, not as giving things up, but as gaining things, gaining time, gaining the opportunity to deepen their relationships with people they care about, engage with issues bigger than themselves, put time into their health, put time into their relationship with the natural world. I think that's the path towards reducing consumption and feeling like our lives are getting better for it.
I love it. So everybody out there, you now have your marching orders. JB, thank you so much. For everybody out there, the book is The Day the World Stops Shopping: How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. It doesn't get much better than that. So again, thank you so much for your time, not only now, but putting together this book and having the heart to make a difference as it relates to our world.
Well, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
All right. Now, for everybody out there, please join us next Monday when Matthew McKay, PhD, will be with us to discuss his new book, The Luminous Landscape of the Afterlife. So we're going to touch on a subject that we haven't looked at in quite some time. And in this interview, Dr. McKay will discuss how he came into this topic after the death of his son, and how deep knowledge meditations can facilitate asking questions and getting support and advice from the other side. And for everybody out there, I'd also like you to visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network and go to whatever platform you listen to us on and please leave a review, make some comments, send us in some questions. This helps other people when they're looking for a positive show like this. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
Hello, I'm Marty Cove. You might remember me from roles such as Sensei in the Karate Kid films. I've done over 100 films and countless stunts in my career, and I've always given 100%. With the damage done to my body over time, I needed to find relief from my chronic pain. My passion for health and fitness drove me to find a natural way to combat muscle pain. Teaming up with doctors, detectives, and a compounding pharmacist, we've created Marty's Cobra Cove Ultra Strength CBD Cream. It's the only thing that has been strong enough to knock out my pain, and fast. Honestly, you may have tried the rest, but it's time to try the best. It's legal, it's safe, and 100% effective. Show your pain no mercy. Go to www.martyscobracove.com.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.